You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and holder in perpetuity of the record for strikeouts in a seven-inning game in the University Heights Little League in the Bronx. And since that Little League is now a memory, that record, 16 strikeouts in a seven-inning game, like Cy Young's 511 wins, will live forever. Thank you very much. Now, for reasons best known to themselves, the good people here at MLB.com have bestowed this honor upon me to host a weekly podcast, and to my knowledge, they did so without any gunplay or money changing hands. That's what you get for hanging around the game for a long time. No, not since the dead ball era, or that Abner Doubleday handed me the tape measure and said, "What do you think? 60 feet from home plate to the mound? No, you know what, Abner? Let's add another 6 inches." We'll produce a show that will be fun, informative, distinctive, and unique, bringing to you compelling topical stories you won't hear anyplace else. So, I ask you to give us a chance. Tell your friends, and I hope you'll make this appointment radio. And now to our show. Our leadoff hitter was also my first guest when I began a radio show in New York way back in the early 21st century. And in the interest of complete disclosure, I wrote his book, Memories of the Game, but for reasons unknown, it went unpublished. Fortunately, he didn't hold that against me and honors me and my audience on this inaugural edition of Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Live and direct for us is the most famous vintner near Napa, California, in nearby Calistoga. The proprietor of the GTS Vineyard, that stands for George Thomas Seaver, called the franchise, the greatest pitcher in New York Mets history, Hall of Famer, George Thomas Seaver, the same George Thomas Seaver, with 311 wins, 3 Cy Young Awards, 3 ERA titles, 5 strikeout titles, 8 All-Star games, and until Griffey Jr., the highest vote plurality of anyone elected to the Hall of Fame. What an honor it is to have you on the show, which hopefully will go more than one edition. first of all, how are you feeling? How are you doing?
I'm feeling better. I got turned in the paper, et cetera, just as, you know, so people would know, is that I've got Lyme disease. And interesting that I got it when I was in Connecticut. And one of the doctors I talked to said, you know, you've had it so badly, you know, so deeply that you'll never get it again when in fact, I find out that it never goes away. So one of the things I'm doing is I have a vineyard here, about 3.5 acres, and I get as much cardiovascular 7 days a week as I possibly can. Because I have slope on, you know, I have grades that I have to go up, and I love the work that I do. I don't do any real technical work, but I do rough pruning and other things like that. And I enjoy my day immensely. I don't have to travel and all that stuff. And I'm out here with my 3 Labradors, and we have, you know, usually about 5, 6, or 7 hours a day, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I take time and have my lunch and do a puzzle or whatever. But I really enjoy it. And we've been quite successful with our vineyard. And we sell out in about 5 days.
Wow.
And we have 2,000 people on the waiting list. And if you're a winemaker, I mean a wine lover, the story that I tell is I'm sitting next to a guy in on an airplane going to New York. This is several years ago. And he said, "What are you doing now, Tom?" I said, "I'm doing. I've got vineyards that I work in every 7 days a week, and et cetera." And I said, "South facing slope on Diamond Mountain, et cetera. Jim Barber does the vineyard and takes care of the vineyard, all the technical stuff that has to get done." And I said, "Thomas Brown is the winemaker. The guy gave me a check and signed it." He said, "Just fill it in and send it to me."
Wow.
Honest to God. And he's been that, and I don't remember, I can't remember his name. I mean, this Lyme disease, it affects your, I wouldn't remember. I don't remember. I could look it up on the computer or have Nancy do that.
I have it down that the effects are memory loss, trouble sleeping, nausea, and a general overall feeling of chemical imbalance. And that, Tom, you first contracted this back in 1991. That's 25 years ago, while you were working in your garden when you were living in Greenwich, Connecticut. And for nearly 20 years, for nearly 20 years, it lay dormant. And then what happened?
And then it came back. And one of the doctors I talked to said, you had it so deeply, you'll never get it again. And that's just, it's just, they were still learning about this. But you just have it. You know, it doesn't mean I have it every day. You know, it doesn't affect me every day. Today is like, I'm out here in my vineyard, I'm doing my work, et cetera. I've got my dogs on beautiful mountain and Diamond Mountain in Calistoga, Napa Valley. I mean, it's just,
you got good days and bad days.
It's the diet, yeah.
Right, and there's no cure. And there's no cure for this.
I would have trouble getting memory is part of it, and then it affects you. And I don't know that I would be able to drive to the airport and not get lost. You know, because there's pressure and all that other stuff. But I mean, there's nothing. I'm in the vineyard, et cetera, and I get my work done, and I do a crossword puzzle. My dogs and I are now sitting underneath a tree, and et cetera, and I'm having a really good day.
That's great.
I'm getting a 9 out of 10 today. So, I mean, I'm not affected by it every day, but it hangs around, and it's a pain in the rear end is what it is.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a memory loss as well, and it's awful.
Yeah,
everybody has a chance of getting it in the East. You know, I had it.
Right.
I mean, I still have it. You know, but I get as much work in as I possibly can, and I feel I don't know if it's true or not or whatever. Psychologically, I'm burning this crap out of my system.
Right. Good for you.
And I'm having a 10 today. I am having a number 10 today.
Good. Well, and so are we, because we're talking to Tom Seaver on this inaugural edition of Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Tom, what got you interested in the wine business?
I had my brother-in-law, was my sister's husband, and we were, they lived in Boston and stuff, and we went out to dinner one night in New York, and he said, the poignant question is, what are you going to do when you're done, Tom, you know? And there was a point in my life that I was going to manage, I was going to general manage, I was going to be the commissioner, I was going to be my life, you know. And and at the point, it was later in my career, and I said, I said, just word it out. You know, we're having dinner someplace in New York, and I said, I'm going to go back to California, and I'm going to raise grapes. And I never forgot that I said it. I don't know where it came from, you know. And I ended up finding up a piece of property, 116 acres, and we built a house, and I put vineyard in, and it's south. These are technical words, and think about this. South-facing slope on Diamond Mountain. So the sun, you understand, I'm getting the sun here. I'm not facing the north. I'm facing south with my vineyard, et cetera. And it just, I saw a lot of people, Ed, that the game was over for them. You know, they had to give up their uniform, and they were lost. And I would see them, and that was just when I was a player, and they were lost. There was no more clubhouse to go to, no more uniform to put on, and it was the saddest thing I ever saw. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And I thought about, what are you going to do, you know? And one of the things about it was that, you know what, I love the gardening aspect. I did a lot of gardening in Connecticut, et cetera. And I said, I'm going to get a vineyard. I'm going to buy the land and created it from step one, you know. And I'm in the vineyard every day working. And I love the work. I'm not going to sit at a I don't sit at a desk and work on a computer. I get the sun. I'm usually in the vineyard when the sun is coming out, and I'm going to work. Mm-hmm. If I want to sit down and do a puzzle, I'll come sit underneath the tree where I am, a series of trees where I'm sitting, and with my dogs, and I'm, you know, and I do a lot of the physical work.
Right, the grunt work.
That have to get done in the vineyard.
Right. Like that kind of grunt work would involve what? You said you don't do the technical work, you do the grunt work, which is what?
Okay, so you have shoots of the vineyard, you know, and these canes got up. Well, I cut them down to about six inches for the first catch wire, for the bottom catch wire, et cetera. And then the pros come in and do the fine pruning, et cetera. But I do all the grunt work of getting the upper growth out of the way. You know, and I follow them, and I don't do that work because I don't want to do the technical work because I'm afraid I'll screw it up.
Mm.
See what I mean? I'm doing simple grunt work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just exciting as hell, Ed.
That's great. Tom was.
And then we make our own wine, and Thomas Brown is the winemaker. Jim Barber is the vineyard manager. You know, and there's I'm working every day, and you know it's $125 a bottle. And I was on it like I told you guy on the plane. I said I'm south facing slope on Diamond Mountain. He says I'll take it.
Wow.
You know, I told him the principles. I told him it's Jim Barber does the farming, Thomas Brown who's by the way his uncle was Bobby Richardson.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm repeating myself because that's all part of what this line is. But anyway, it is to die for me. It's to die for. I get my boots on, I'm my yada yada, and I go to work.
I heard that in preparation for the you're throwing out a first pitch at the All-Star game at Citi Field a couple of years ago, that you and one of your wine guys were throwing back and forth just so you could get back in shape to throw that first pitch.
Yeah, I didn't want to embarrass myself. You don't know how much it hurt, too. I walked out there and I said, boy, this is going to hurt. And I don't want to bounce the goddamn thing.
No, of course not. No, you can't. Then you're disgraced. They always say, don't bounce it. How difficult was it, Tom, to convince Nancy, your wife of 50 years, to leave Greenwich, Connecticut and come to California and start this new life?
Well, she was ready to kill me, you know. We had a beautiful home in Connecticut, and our children were raised in the East, and both of them went to Boston College, and et cetera, et cetera. And I just went to her, and I said, I don't want to be Tom Seaver anymore. I don't want to do that. I don't want, I'm not trying to hurt people's feelings, but I did not want to spend my life playing charity golf tournaments. I did enough of that. I want to do something that excites me to get to work. I loved pitching. I loved going to work. And that was the key. I loved going to work, going to the ballpark. Pitching against Richie Allen with runners at first and third, one out, and you got to get a double play, things like that. You know, I mean that's, and I'm still that way. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I love it. I absolutely adore it. I just adore it.
And you weren't afraid to do it.
Pardon me?
You were not afraid to do it.
No. I mean, I wasn't afraid at all. Not at all. And you ask people, you know. I mean, I wanted to do Zinfandel. She said, you know, and I brought somebody over here, Jim Barber, and I said, he said, this is what people are dying for. You found a raw piece of land, and we get it, you know, and we turn it into a vineyard, et cetera. And he says, you plant Cabernet. I said, that's what I said. I want to do Cabernet. But it's like you talk to me about pitching. I will give you a doctorate. You know, understand what I mean? And I listen to them, and they're the pros. Mm. You know.
Yeah.
And I've loved every aspect of it.
But more importantly, to a point that you made just a few moments ago, that you didn't want to go to the end of your life and wonder what could have been.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I wanted. I wanted to do the. I don't know where it came from. I mean, I love wine. I love French wine, and we've gone to the vineyards in France, et cetera. It just fascinated me. Mm. You know, and it's a lot. I'm not going to sit in front of a computer. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to the vineyard. I'm going to work. I'm taking my dogs and go out to this beautiful place where we have, with the mountains, et cetera, everything. And I love it every day.
Can you equate your winery and the success that you're experiencing with that?
I don't have a winery. Again, this is incorrect. I don't have a winery. That is a different financial animal. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That means I would be making the wine here. I don't make it here. I have a winemaker. His name is Thomas Brown, and I say that his uncle was Bobby Richardson.
Right. You did.
Yeah, okay. So a small world of it.
Right.
And it goes over to Outposts where Thomas Brown is based.
Right.
My fruit goes over to Outposts. You know, and that's they make Cabernets and they make wonderful people, you know. And it's vinified over in Outposts. I follow my fruit, et cetera, and all that. It's just a joy, and it has physical. The biggest thing, and I reiterate, and I know I'm repetitive here, but that's
okay.
That's part of the Lyme disease.
I got it.
But I can work physically, work, move, et cetera, up and down the rows. I have slope, et cetera, and it makes my day. It makes my life. And it makes my life, you know.
That's
and I
great.
Go home for lunch.
I know. You said...
I don't go anywhere. This is on my property. And I go home or I go down and I get a sandwich for Nancy Me or get an omelet or whatever, you know. And she runs the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't run it. I can't run it because of this Lyme disease.
Right.
You know, I would screw it up. And I really didn't want to do that. I mean, I would have hired somebody. Nancy has taken the reins and runs it and loves it.
That's
loves
great.
To do it.
That's tremendous.
Yeah.
Do you equate your business with your pitching success? Can you do that? Have you ever done that? You measured the success of your business and this second life with the success of your first life.
Yeah, yes, discipline. Discipline, and there's certain things you do, and I found the things that I have to do, that I get to do, but have to do it correctly, you know, in preparation. I mean, I'll tell you one of my favorite stories about pitching. And I'm warming up in a bullpen in Chicago, and Dave Duncan, who was Tony La Russa's pitching coach when I was with the White Sox, and I forget where I was. I don't know if I was on the road or not. It's academic. That's making a difference. And I'm warming up, and I've got two minutes on the clock, you know, before I have to go in and change my shirt, get a bed, and start the game. I think it was in Chicago. And Dave Duncan, who I adored, he looked at me, and he said, "Now I've got 2 minutes to go," and he said, "Tom, you don't have squat today." He didn't use this word squat, but it sounds like, you know. Well, it is, you know, we were by ourselves and all that. He says, "You don't have squat today, Tom." And I looked at him in the eye, and this is the way I felt him. And I mean, I loved what I did. And I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Well, what's the problem?" That says what it's all about.
Mm.
What's the problem? I said, "They don't know that." Talking about the opposition.
Right, the team
you're
going to face.
They don't know that.
Right.
And by the time they find out, it'll be too late. They're going out to play them again, the opposition. And here it is, you know, future Hall of Famer Tom Seaver, right? I didn't have anything. I mean, my pitching coach told me, "So you don't have anything." dunks it, she's got nothing. I said, they don't know that.
Right, they don't know.
And by the time they that's the story. And by the time they figured out, too late, boys. You know? They're walking, you know, might have been the second inning or something or whatever, and I walk in, get a run.
That's a great story.
Time to win 1-0 if you want.
Sure.
That's the way I felt about what I did for a living. You know, I mean, and that sounds so trite, but it's like an artist. Okay, this is I'm painting. You know. And that's what I did. That's essentially what I did. You know?
I loved it. Well, and millions loved watching you play. We're with Tom Seaver on this first edition of the Ed Randall's Talking Baseball podcast. Before you go, I want to ask you a couple baseball questions. Let me get a couple baseball questions in. You and Piazza closed Shea Stadium. You threw a good pitch that when you did that. And now this summer, he will join you as the only players to have their uniform numbers retired by the Mets. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, good. I will greet him with open arms. Wonderful. Just wonderful. And as in the other thing about this is that I had the record for percentage for the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And who's getting it? You know, who's getting it? It's Junior. And his father and I played together in Cincinnati.
Correct.
And he Griff Sr., he was a charm. Absolutely charmed. Great sense of humor, you know. But when he put the uniform and got to the batter's box, it was totally different, you know. And his son had a real good teacher.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
His father
I couldn't be happier.
Yeah.
I just couldn't be happier. My God.
But Tom, it's astonishing. You were not a unanimous choice. Three people left Junior's name off the ballot. He's not a unanimous choice. It's astonishing. I don't get that. I never have understood
that. Well, I'll tell you what I think about that. I think that has been how many people have been voted in on the first round? Okay,
right.
And then what are the percentages mean? The old timers never voted for anybody in the first.
Exactly the first. Right.
You know, it's just a tradition.
Yep.
You know, there is nobody, you know, if Lou Gehrig can't get in, or whatever, you know, I'm just throwing the name out here, you know, or if Johnny Bench can't get in, you know, and that's, Johnny Bench was either the, you know, anyway, it's part of the tradition, you know, and enough of those old, the so-called old guys, you know, carry that tradition forward. You know, it's sacred. You know, it is sacred for the history of the game. You know. Anyway.
Last thing. Are today's pitchers babied too much?
I don't know if they are or not. I'll tell you one thing, what I would do, and in cases, one thing I would do, if I were a manager, in the situation you're talking about, is go to the mound. And I'm waiting for a manager to do this. I would go to the mound and say, kid, you got good stuff. And I'm not coming back.
Good.
Comprende? It's foxhole mentality.
That's it.
And that a lot of that came from my Marine Corps, the time I spent in the Marine Corps. You got great stuff. I'm not coming back. Bingo. Comprende? Understand what I mean? That's, you know, you get, as a manager, you've got to pull that out. You got to pull that out of their heart. Get it from the heart. Put that into play. You know, it's like talking about Bob Gibson. I mean, is he a foxhole, the foxhole personification of a foxhole player.
Mm-hmm.
He's not coming out. He's not coming out. You know, when I went to the point where you know, when I was throwing, and I didn't do this with Gil. I mean, I was still on the learning curve of what a pitcher is, not what he does, but what he is. You know, and I went over and I talked to John McNamara when I was older, et cetera, and La Russa, Tony, and I went in and I said, okay, don't let X player, don't have player X beat me. Don't let him beat me. I want to take that off of my shoulders. If I can get rid of him, I can walk him, et cetera, and get the next hitter or whatever. That was one of my theories. Don't let player X, Tom, beat you in the last nine outs. That was one of the things that I did.
Mm.
Okay, maybe I had to put him on base. I had to lock him. I had to whatever it was. I'm going against the odds here. But I'm raising the odds because I'm not going to let that guy beat me. You know, now I've got to deal with eight players, not nine.
I think that's great. To use your words, you got great stuff. I'm not coming back. Well, now you've got great stuff in the vineyard, as you did on the mound, and I hope you will come back on this show. What an honor to have you on, Tom, and good and many, many all good days. No Lyme disease problems. Thank you so much for honoring me and my audience and coming on.
Oh, Ed, you're very welcome. Anytime.
And now this. Long before he was the general manager of the now Super Bowl champion Denver Broncos, John Elway played one summer of minor league baseball in the outfield for the Yankees in the Class A New York Penn League. Our guest, who played high school baseball with Jim Fregosi, went on to carve an iconic career as one of the best scouts in our game and was the guy who persuaded George Steinbrenner to take a shot on Elway. Here with us now, Boston Red Sox scout Gary Hughes. Gary, it's great to have you on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Having played with Fregosi, who I understand was a multi-sport god, did you have an attraction to chasing after multi-sport athletes?
I definitely did. Jim was kind of like the guy, my guiding light on that, because he was a four-sport star, really, in high school, including used to broad jump between innings. It was broad jump in those days. Broad jump between innings of baseball games.
Wow. Oh, my God. That's unbelievable. When did you first see John Elway play?
I couldn't come up with a year, but it was when he was a freshman at Stanford. And, you know, he'd been a very good player in Southern California in high school as well. And I first saw him play at Stanford as a freshman.
Mm. He had pitched to a 1.03 earned run average, and he hit .491 to lead his high school to the L.A. City Championship before you saw him, and then he was chosen 18th by Kansas City, but he chose instead to go to Stanford. Now you're working for an organization that a baseball organization that has got so much football influence. George Steinbrenner was a former assistant coach at Purdue. The Yankees president was Lou Saban, who coached many years in college and pros, coached the Buffalo Bills in the NFL, and Howard Hopalong Cassidy was a coach in the system, and he had won the Heisman Trophy, and Steinbrenner just loved the football players, Gary.
He did. And, you know, you kind of misspoke when we introduced this because you said, I talked George into it. Actually, George talked me into it. He was in love with the idea of John Elway.
He was. All because of the football mentality that this guy had?
Right. That plus, you know, I had a nice report in, a real good report in on him, and so did one of our cross checkers, at least, and it, you know, his ability in baseball was outstanding, and it was, the question was whether he was going to play baseball professionally, and I didn't feel he would, and told George that, and then he said, well, we got to take it. And the next voice, the next thing he said was, but he's got to play baseball. And I said, wait a minute. He said, and this was on a squawk box. I was talking to him, and I was sitting. Al Rosen and Saban, Lou was there, and so was all our front office people, and they're pushing me towards the front of the squawk box. I'm a third-year scout with the Yankees, and I'm talking to George, saying, wait a minute, I want to keep this job. I don't want you to come back and tell me that you know, I said he was going to play baseball because I was pretty sure he'd play football.
So you didn't want to draft John Elway?
Oh, no, no, no. I wanted to draft him. And that's another thing. I wanted to draft him, but I didn't think we had to take him as high as we took him.
Right.
We took him in the second round. We did not have a first-round pick. And in those days, there were two rounds, and then they shut it down. Then they had the secondary phase, which is for Passover players that had been drafted before and hadn't signed. And then the next day, we start with the third round. And George's feeling was that if we wait until that, people are going to sleep on it. They're going to look at their board and see that Elway's by far the best player on the board, and they'll take him before we'll get a shot at him in the third round or fourth or fifth, whatever. And he was probably right at that.
So Elway goes number two in 1981. You did not have a number one because, as you said, you had signed Dave Winfield from San Diego. And the feeling was you could have waited until the middle rounds, but George didn't want to take that chance.
Yeah, and again, I think he was right. I think they would have looked at it and figured, well, you know, maybe. So this is our best chance. Let's take a shot at him. And that's basically what we were doing.
In preparing for this interview, Gary, I read something and I want you to confirm it. Did John Elway spend spring break with the Yankees?
No, no, no. Well, here's what happened. He was drafted in 1981. Now, that was his sophomore year. He was eligible for the draft because he was 21 years old as a sophomore. He didn't play baseball again until the following summer. He played, we didn't sign him until three games into his junior year in football. It's get a little confusing. He was playing football. The rule at the time was if you were eligible to sign until you went to your first class. Stanford starts late. Stanford starts in late September. The football team had already played three games of his junior year, and we signed him then.
So after the draft, what happens? He gets picked number two, and then?
He gets picked number two, and then we talk about signing, yes, no, goes back and forth. And we finally sign him in September of his junior year. We drafted him in June of that year. Mm-hmm. You know, as when he was a sophomore, became a junior when he went to school in September. But before he went to school, we signed him for a contract then. And then the following summer, he played at Oneonta, New York, in the New York Penn League. Over a year, he hadn't played baseball.
Right, and perhaps because of that, Gary started off slowly, something like 1-for-19.
Not something exactly like you've done your homework. Exactly like 1-for-19. Ended up leading the team in every offensive category 6 weeks later, including stolen bases.
Yeah, right. He led the team in stolen bases in only 42 games. He had 25 RBIs, four homers. He hit .318. And I guess some guys decided they were going to run on him, Gary, because he led the league in outfield assists with eight of them.
I did not realize that. That's amazing. It's not amazing. That's amazing. I didn't know it, but nice.
Years ago, I'm doing a television show, also called, ironically, Ed Randall's Talking Baseball, and I got an opportunity to go to Hawaii for the old NFL Quarterback Challenge, where they're going to throw the footballs through tires and all this other stuff. And so there's seven or eight quarterbacks, and I get to interview all of them talking baseball. And I'm talking to Troy Aikman about being drafted by the Mets and Danny Marino about being drafted by, I believe it was the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I talked to Elway. And I said to Elway, Gary, you know, I saw Barfield throw. I saw Winfield throw. I saw Maris throw. I can't imagine what it would have been like to have had you throw from right field in old Yankee Stadium. It would have been amazing.
Exactly. No, you know, and the one thing I want to correct is obviously, you'd say Dan Marino and Pittsburgh Pirates. Dan Marino was also drafted by the Kansas City Royals.
Right. Yeah, right. So he plays that one season, and then I read that George Steinbrenner wrote a long letter to the family trying to seduce their son, telling them how great it would be for him to be a New York Yankee.
Well, I don't doubt that. And Lou and I went out and talked to the family. Lou Saban and I went out and talked to the family. We talked a lot. It was just a mom and dad, Jack Elway and Janet, and Jan, and they were there, and Lou and I. We had a wonderful dinner, a wonderful evening, talking a lot about football. But John wasn't there at that particular time.
after Oneonta, did you think you had a shot, or did you think he was really going to go football?
Well, there you go. What happened is this. He pulled an Eli Manning before Eli Manning. He told the Baltimore Colts, who had the first pick, don't take me. I there's a lot of reasons. I'm just not going to want to play there. And they turned around and took him anyhow. So John and I were out fishing one day. This is while we still had him under control. He still hadn't signed the football contract. I said, well, what are you going to do? And he says, unless Baltimore trades me, I'm going to play baseball. I said, you're full of malarkey. And he says, I'm telling you. And, I mean, he was pretty darn convincing about it. Anyway, he must have convinced Baltimore because they traded him. And he went to Denver, and that was the end of his baseball career.
But the Yankees, when you were there, operated under the theory that nobody was unsignable, right?
George would always ask, you know, when we talk about unsignable players. And George would sit in on the meeting sometime, and this guy's unsignable. And George said, well, his question was always, what does his father do? and I mean, I heard him more than once say it, many more times than once say that. And, you know, if the dad was a school teacher or something like that, George says, he's signable.
He's signable. And reportedly, he had offered an escalating 5-year contract to John Elway that would have paid him, Gary, $500,000 per year, the wealthiest contract in history for a guy with just 42 games of professional experience. And this would have been Valhalla for every agent ever negotiating for the rest of history for a number one draft choice.
I got to tell you, honest to God, this is the first I've heard that.
And yet Elway declines to continue his baseball career and goes on to be drafted first overall in the 1983 draft. But I'm sure there have been many times, Gary, in your wonderful baseball life that you have watched Elway and wondered what he could have done in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, one of the times was when he invited myself, my wife, and our whole family to his wedding. And I watched him walk down the aisle, and I said, he still looked good in pinstripes.
That's great. Gary, we're so happy to have you with me. I really appreciate your kindness and your time. And best of luck this year to you and the Boston Red Sox.
Ed, one little thing real quick before we hang up. The thing about John that will tell you all you need to know about him. I mentioned we were out fishing. At the end of the day, at the end of the morning, we came in and had a real nice lunch, and we're going to part company. And he said, do you think we could go out again? We had been skunked in the morning. And John was embarrassed. The competitor in him came out. And sure enough, I asked the people who were taking us out fishing. They said, sure, come on, let's go. So we went out. We caught one fish the rest of the day. John caught it. I told him it's because you're a natural athlete.
That's great. Gary, thank you so much for your time and great story talking about John Elway and the recent Super Bowl champion Denver Broncos. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ed.
Thank you. That's Gary Hughes of the Boston Red Sox. Little trivia question for you. Who's the only player who compiled at least 400 total bases in 5 different seasons? Nobody else has ever done it in 4. We'll give you the answer in a moment. This week in history, in 1929, the Red Sox are finally allowed to play home games on Sundays, but they must do so at the home of the Boston Braves because it's felt Fenway Park sits too close to a church. In 1931, the Chicago White Sox and New York Giants played the first night game, an exhibition in Houston. In 1943, Joe DiMaggio enlisted in the Army for $50 a month. The following year, 1944, the Cincinnati Reds signed 15-year-old Joe Nuxhall a day after he played in a high school basketball game. In 1946, Danny Gardella, an outfielder for the New York Giants, jumped to the Mexican League for more money. He was never allowed back to play in the major leagues. In 1950, both Bill Terry and Mel Ott were shut out of the Hall of Fame. Nobody was elected that year. In 1953, Augie Bush bought the St. Louis Cardinals. The price? $3.75 million. Less than what Matt Harvey will make from the Mets in 2016. In 1960, the demolition of Ebbets Field in Brooklyn begins, but not before they sing the national anthem. In 1969, Ted Williams returns to baseball full-time. signing a five-year contract to manage the Washington Senators. He wouldn't last 5 years. In 1980, Billy Martin signs on to manage the Oakland A's. Soon after, Billy Ball is born. In 1986, Raleigh Fingers, looking to hang on with the Cincinnati Reds at the end of his career, chooses to end his career rather than shave off his trademark handlebar mustache to conform to the Reds' rule of no facial hair. In 1988, Chicago aldermen vote to allow the installation of lights in Wrigley Field with the provision that no more than 18 games can be played at night. And in 1989, Orl Hershiser became the first $3 million player. Trivia question, who was the only player who compiled at least 400 total bases in five different seasons? No one else has done it four times. The answer, the Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig. So that's our show, the first edition, and hopefully not the last, of Ed Randall's Talking Baseball here on MLB.com. If you are mobile, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.